Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 1220, State v. Phillips. Arguing for the petitioner, Stephen Tsushima. Arguing for the respondent, Randall Hironaka. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Tsushima and Mr. Hironaka. Are you both ready to proceed today? We are. All right. And Mr. Tsushima, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so the warning light will come on with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Hironaka, we will give you a five-minute warning at the end of your argument. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning.
And Associate Justices. At the outset, I would like to apologize to this Court. I would like to apologize because the submissions before the ICA and the trial court did not explicitly argue the consent exception to the warrant requirement. However, those submissions before those courts do not control this Court's review of the constitutional issue before it. As this Court is well aware, this Court reviews questions of constitutional law de novo under the right or wrong standard, and thus exercises its own individual constitutional judgment based on the facts of this case. What that means is this Court examines the facts and answers the question without being required to give any weight to the trial court's answer to it. In looking at the facts of this case, this Court will be satisfied that in reviewing the facts under the consent exception to the warrant requirement, that where defendant in this case called 911 to summon the police to his house and invited the police into his house to investigate a crime purportedly committed by an unknown third person, defendant had impliedly consented for the police to investigate and search his home. Now there are 8 points which I'd like to point out in the record, which show that defendant impliedly consented to the search of his house. And of course, the scope of the search must be reasonably related to its purpose, and that's under Nakamoto, 64 Hawaii at 24.
Mr. Shishima, let me ask you, even assuming the gun was, the hammer was fair game, but what about the clothes in the garbage can? How can you construe consent on that?
We believe it will fall under what was the reasonable scope of the search because the police were called by defendant to investigate the circumstances.
Is that really? Where is the finding that that was the purpose for the police being called?
It starts with, first, of course, the 911 call that defendant made to the police. And I can read part of what I have transcribed.
Oh, I'm sorry, but since consent was never argued to the trial court, in terms of the findings, the trial court said that the defendant had called police to report that he had discovered his wife injured to the head. So it appears that he was calling for a medical emergency.
What the record will also show is that he was calling specifically the police to investigate.
Where is that finding?
It won't be in the finding of the final fact conclusion of
the. So are you asking this court to then now make findings?
I'm asking
that
this court
apply to the implied consent.
Correct. I'm asking this court to apply the de novo review and to apply its own constitutional judgment based on the facts that were listed at the hearing.
But in order for this court to exercise its own constitutional judgment as to implied consent, wouldn't this court have to make then additional findings based on the transcript?
Correct, based on the evidence that was adduced at the hearing, as well as the evidence that was adduced at trial. Because as this court knows, and I'd like to quote this part, when the defendant's pretrial motion to suppress is denied and the evidence is subsequently introduced at trial, the defendant's appeal of the denial of the motion to suppress is actually an appeal of the introduction of the evidence at trial. Consequently, when deciding an appeal of the pretrial denial of the defendant's motion to suppress, the appellate court considers both the record of the hearing on the motion to suppress and the record at trial, and that's under State v. Collin, 77-264. So we would not only ask that this court independently look at the facts adduced at the hearing, but also at the facts that were adduced at trial.
Counsel, the legal principle about implied consent the whole proposition of implied consent is that it can be revoked as soon as the person is a suspect, or the person can just say to the police, get out of here, you guys are getting too close to the evidence. Is that a legal principle we want to adopt in this jurisdiction? I mean, you began by apologizing for not raising this argument. Let me ask you something else. Doesn't implied consent mean it's an exception, right?
That's
to the search warrant requirement.
Right.
Before you can have an exception, you have to have a search, right?
Correct.
Did the defendant in this case exhibit, I mean, a search is two prongs for a search, correct? One is that the defendant exhibits an expectation of privacy. And did the defendant in this case, by calling the police and the fire people, exhibit an expectation of privacy?
No, that's where he did not exhibit an expectation of privacy. That's where he exhibited a diminished expectation of privacy and consented to the investigation at his home.
So why are we talking implied consent?
We are talking under consent, and a consent can be viewed as either expressed or implied.
No, let me retrench. A little bit what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
To restate it. You don't get to consent unless there's a search. You don't have a search unless there's the person exhibits an expectation of privacy and one that society deems reasonable. A person who calls the police because his wife has been beaten almost to death, does that person exhibit an expectation of privacy?
Not in their home, Your Honor, because when they're calling the police to investigate the circumstances surrounding the bludgeoning of their wife, they're implicitly consenting to the investigation that some subsequently
keep going to consent, and I guess I don't get to consent because I don't get to search. You only consent when there's a search.
What else would a defendant be calling the police for other than to search and investigate the circumstances surrounding the crime?
Isn't that really the issue as to...
And just so I'm clear.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, let me try. What is the impediment, or what did the ICA find was the impediment to implying the plain view doctrine? I mean, it's undisputed the officer was invited into the garage where the hammer was found, and it appears that the ICA found that the doctrine, although perhaps otherwise applicable, didn't apply because it wasn't in that initial intrusion that the hammer was observed, but subsequently after another officer, I believe, or one of the officers was asked to go by a supervisor to look around the house and then found it. What is the problem under the plain view doctrine with finding that the second officer was legitimately in the house and could legitimately see things that were in plain view?
The problem with the ICA's rationale is it's looking at the evidence under an exception that doesn't squarely apply based on the facts of this case. The consent exception to the warrant requirement is what squarely applies in this case. So what the trial court did was it came to the right conclusion but the wrong reasoning.
Well, he consented to their presence in his house, correct?
Correct.
Okay, at that point, wholly apart from the question of whether he was consenting to a search or not, if they were rightfully there and they saw things in plain view, they could, if they constituted contraband, they could investigate further and potentially seize them, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then, so if I understood correctly, what the ICA felt was that because the test is articulated by this court is that the discovery has to be inadvertent, the discovery in this case wasn't inadvertent, and that was a problem. And what's your position with regard to that?
My position is that the ICA's rationale in applying the exception of the plain view doctrine is what was wrong. That's where I apologize from the get-go, because what the proper exception that the court should have applied in looking at the constitutional issue was consent, because consent was clearly given. That consent was given, the police rightfully began to investigate the circumstances for which they were called to the house for. It's exactly what society would expect the officers to do and exactly what defendant had asked them to do. And that's where I was going to start reading from the transcription of the 911 call. At the beginning, it says, "Police, hello, how can I help you? Defendant, I need the police and an ambulance. Someone beat my wife in the head. Someone beat my wife in the head. Someone came in the house." Later on, the operator asks, "Is the person still there?" Defendant answers, "Ma'am, no, ma'am, no one is here. I came home from riding around and found my wife sleeping. She's snoring. Her head is bashed in." Later on, the operator asks, "Okay, we're sending everybody there to the apartment 504, sir." Defendant, "Yes, ma'am." Later on, the operator asks, "Did you see it? Who did it?" Defendant, "No, ma'am, no one is here." Operator asks, "Does it look like someone broke in or do you think she fell?" Defendant, "No, ma'am, I couldn't sleep. So I went for a drive, the garage is acting up, open, you know, oh my goodness." The operator asks, "Did someone break into your house?" Defendant, "No, ma'am, no, ma'am, I could not sleep. So I went driving and I left the garage door open."
I'd like to get back to what the CJ was asking you about, the plain view. Haven't we said case after case, Meyer, it's in Kuntapai, it's in Wallace, and we have repeated the rationale behind the inadvertent discovery rule is that we will not excuse officers from the general requirement to seize if the officers know the location of the evidence. Did the officers know the location of the evidence?
No, they did not know the location.
Could they have obtained a search warrant?
Yes, they could have obtained a search warrant.
Could they have obtained it before they found the hammer?
Before they found the hammer? In case I haven't made it clear, we're not relying upon the plain view doctrine in this case. We're relying upon the consent doctrine.
Okay. Well, the plain view doctrine was applied by the circuit court.
Right.
And I'm not sure how any police officer could have gotten a warrant for a hammer that he didn't know existed before he started looking for it. So my question to you is, I understand how the ICA made a definition of plain view, but I don't see it in our cases, I don't see it in Coolidge, because unless you know the existence of the object before you look for it, and unless you know that you can get a warrant for it, then it's inadvertent.
And I believe the question you were asking was, how would the police have got a search warrant? They already knew the circumstances once Officer Collins had gone upstairs and observed the condition of the room. Defendant's wife was lying on the bed with a puddle of blood under her head. Every wall had blood splattered on it, including the ceiling on the fan on the ceiling. Under these circumstances, it was very clear, based on what defendant had already informed the operator and their visual observations, that a crime had been committed in this house and that there could be important evidence that could be found within the house. Based on those circumstances, I do believe that the police could have got a search warrant in this case.
Before they knew there was any evidence there. Before, at that point in time, when Officer Tokunaga, just after he gets there, he's told to walk around, at that point in time, they could have run and stopped what they were doing and gotten a search warrant.
Because it was very clear to them, just from those initial observations, that a crime had been committed within the home, yes.
Let me read to you from Coolidge. "Finally, the plain view doctrine has been applied where a police officer is not searching for evidence against the accused, but nonetheless inadvertently comes across an incriminating object."
And in this case, based on their initial observations in the initial beginning part of the investigation, they would have no reason to believe that defendant was the accused. However, at the same time, they would know that, based on the facts that it appears, and based on the representations given by defendant, that a crime had been committed in that house.
Why had the defendant been placed in the car and before the discovery of the hammer and as the officer testified, not free to leave?
Officer Ahn had explained that. He had testified that it isn't uncommon in cases where there's victims or someone who's been a witness of a violent crime to someone very close to them, that they're concerned for their safety, their own safety, because they're in a state of mind that they don't want to see them do any harm to themselves. Also, as far as the evidence around the area, they don't want them unwittingly tainting any of the evidence by just. So for those reasons, that is why he was stationed to stay with defendant by the car.
But he was not free to leave.
He was free to leave.
I thought he testified he wasn't, he was, and then he wasn't.
That's correct.
On rebuttal, said he wasn't.
That is correct. What he ultimately explained is he would not want him to leave because he is an important witness to the event. He's the last person to have witnessed his wife.
When did these kind of conversations about the fugitive occur in relationship to the discovery of the hammer?
They occurred subsequent to the discovery of the hammer and at the police station, if I remember right, once he was escorted to the police station.
It was on the ride that they first started talking about the fugitive, or was it while he was in the car in the house?
I believe he might have brought it out outside the police station. Might have been the first time. I'm not 100% clear on that. I do apologize for that. But the discovery of the hammer occurred approximately 4:30. There was no officer that specifically testified as to the time of the viewing of the hammer, but how we're able to know that is that Officer Ahn arrived at the scene at 4:30 and she was told that a hammer had been discovered. And we also know it was before 5 o'clock, before defendant had left, because he had made inquisition as to the hammer being the weapon that was discovered.
When Officer Collins arrived, he was led through the garage to the bedroom, is that correct?
He was waved into the garage by the defendant.
Through the garage, and that's how they entered the house.
Correct.
And the hammer is right there by the door going into the house.
Correct. And at that point, the officers didn't have any information other than what was what I read to you on the 911 call. All they know is that some incident happened to an individual at the home.
And that doesn't seem like plain view to you.
That the plain view doctrine is not what we're relying upon. Correct. It is the consent exception to the warrant requirement.
If we do not adopt the consent exception, then how would you argue that the hammer should not be suppressed?
I would not. I'm relying fully on the consent exception.
Okay. So if the consent exception is not adopted, you concede that the hammer should have been suppressed?
I believe there are problems to the analysis under the plain view doctrine. Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And those problems would be?
With regard to the second prong of the plain view doctrine, the inadvertent discovery, I believe that might have been where you're
going. That's not the position you had at the circuit court. That's not the circuit judge's ruling. And because the ICA put in an intentional requirement citing no authority, you're disavowing the plain view doctrine?
Because those submissions don't control this court's review of the facts of this case, and this court reviews the facts of the hearing de novo, yes. What's important is whether defendant's right, constitutional right, to the Fourth Amendment protection of unreasonable searches and seizures was violated, and that's what's before this court. And so this court applies its own independent constitutional judgment, and we're confident that when this court looks at the facts of this case, that it's abundantly clear that the consent exception to the warrant requirement.
Do you think that the defendant had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the trash bin that was covered?
Not under the circumstances of this case. What this court will want to look at are the totality of the circumstances. And in this instance, defendant's entire demeanor and interaction with the police was cooperative. It was, in fact, he wanted the police to investigate this crime involving his wife. So, no, he would not have a reasonable expectation of privacy because, and it goes back to the fact of how the officers observed that bedroom. That they had observed blood splattered everywhere. It would not be inconceivable that a person who had committed this crime would have got blood on themselves, and that person would not want to walk out of that house with clothing still on them and would want to discard them. A proper investigation to that would include trash receptacles, and anyone who's asking the police to investigate such a crime would not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the receptacle because they would want the police to look in the receptacle if there's potential evidence of the crime in there.
especially when they found the hammer in the same location, in the garage.
In the garage.
And they weren't even looking for it.
Well, if there's no reasonable expectation of privacy, then how is it a search?
I don't know if I fully understand the question.
Well, you said that
it's not a search in the constitutional sense because consent was given. But
do you need to consent if there's no reasonable expectation of privacy?
Well, you need to consent because that's what gives the police the understanding that you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy because you have consented to the search, because you have consented to the investigation, and then looking around your premises for the purposes of the investigation, of what you've called them for the very purpose you've called them for.
But under your interpretation, wouldn't the scope of the consent really extend to any closed receptacle within the house? Because arguably, any closed receptacle in the house could have the hammer, it could have clothing, it could have things that were secreted by the perpetrator. So is it your contention that by asking the police to come in, the defendant consented to a search of really any closed receptacle in that property?
We believe it does, Your Honor, but ultimately it has to be reasonably related to the purpose that it's called for. The scope of the search cannot go beyond that. For instance, if the police...
Is it a search?
Is it a search? Yes. It is a search in the most common view sense. And for instance, if the police had searched his computer and looked at information on there, I think that would have been going beyond the scope of the search, because what information would they...
Isn't that why in Lopez they use the term diminished expectation of privacy? Because if you allow police to come into your home when you called them because of some terrible event, you're not exhibiting a reasonable expectation of privacy as to the police coming in the areas that they're allowed into your home. It's the only reason they use the word diminished and not none because they're not allowed to go into your computer probably.
Correct.
But what the police did in this case, and following Justice Akiyama, what she's asking, is there even a search in this case since there's no expectation of privacy that's exhibited? And it's certainly one that society would likely not call reasonable when you call the police to come in to help you.
Yes, that's correct. In that sense, yes, that's correct. I did not understand that question fully that way. I do believe that there are circumstances where it could exceed, or there is an expectation of privacy, like I said, with the computer, or if they start going to, say, locked cabinets or a safe in the defendant's home.
What's the difference between that and a garbage can and what he throws in it?
Because those are specific things that, for one, when you're looking at the computer or if you're looking into lock cabinets or a safe, the only person at that point you're looking for evidence against would be the defendant. And in that case, that would take them outside of the consent exception.
Or what about the medicine cabinet to see if there were, drugs or something in the medicine cabinet?
Along the same lines, Your Honor, I agree. But in this case, the trash receptacle is not equivalent to that for the reasons that I just previously stated. There were eight facts that showed that the defendant impliedly consented. It was the 911 call tape, which I had read, which is State's Exhibit 42. It was defendant waving Officer Collins into the garage. When Officer Collins asked him what are the circumstances or what had happened, the defendant had stated, it's my wife, she's upstairs in the bedroom. The defendant then pointed to the bedroom upstairs. During the police investigation, the defendant demonstrated for the police that the garage door opener was malfunctioning. When Officer Rivera took pictures of the hammer, the defendant asked her whether that's the weapon that was used, and she responded that she wasn't sure that they're still investigating. This shows very acutely that the defendant was aware that the police were searching his premises for evidence of the crime. Lastly, during the interview at the police station, the defendant did not withdraw his consent at any time, even when told by the police officers that we may have to, quote, process more of your house. All of these facts, when you look at together, clearly show that the defendant had consented to a search of his house in this case. If this court doesn't have any further questions, I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Hiranaka at this time.
Good Morning.
Good morning,
Mr. Justice, Associate Justices. 15 to 16 hours after the unconstitutional searches in this case, a warrant was obtained. 10 hours after the unconstitutional seizures in this case, a warrant was obtained. These are undisputed facts of this case, and whether you're an attorney or you're not, there are perhaps no other facts of this case which offend reason and common sense more than these.
I don't think it's undisputed whether or not those were unconstitutional.
Well, I do want to address from the get-go your question as well as Justice Nakayama's, position that there is no search here because there's no expectation of privacy, and I could not disagree with that more. There is an absolute difference between calling 911, telling the police that someone is injured in your home, allowing them inside, and equating that.
Why would you call the police if it was just for an injury? Why did he say, I want police and an ambulance? If it's an injury, you call an ambulance.
Well, I'm not sure the normal person understands that when you call 911, basically you're alerting.
The first question they ask is police, fire, or ambulance.
Right.
And he said police and ambulance, right?
Well, because at that point, his expectation is that somebody came in, did something to his wife. So we'll concede that point. But there is a difference between allowing them into your home to care for an injured person and allowing them in there to search basically without any restriction for whatever they want.
This is a lot different position than you took down below in the circuit court, right?
Well, to clarify my position, and it may be somewhat inconsistent. I understand the concept that if you call 911, you say somebody's injured in your home, you're allowing the police into your home. You're allowing them to care for that person. But there's a whole another concept to say that you can go ahead and search. It'd be the same as if I got into a fight with my wife.
He invited them into the garage. The testimony is your client, when the officer arrived, where was he? When he was motioning you to come forward, he was in his garage area.
That's correct.
He said, come forward. And at the circuit court, he said, we won't deny that the officers decided to hammer you, and that it was lawful. I mean, they were in the house. They were there because, Phillips had called 911, and they were there. They had a right to be there at the time.
They had a right to be in the house. They did not have a right to search the house. If they discovered things.
This evidence is found in the garage.
That's correct. That's right.
So what are we even talking about house?
Well, I mean that from the standpoint that the garage is part of the house. But there's a fine line between saying the hammer's out there for anybody to observe, and yet other officers went into the garage and did not observe it, and what Officer Tokunaga was specifically ordered to do, which was to find evidence related to what happened that day or that evening. And so we can't now go back and say, hey, listen, if it's okay for them to be there, and the thing is out in the open on a cooler for anybody to see, then it's okay that they saw it, because that's not what they said. They didn't say that I just happened to notice it when I was searching either for suspects or I was searching for other victims. They specifically were seeking out evidence related to the crime. And there's a difference between allowing people into your home for an emergency situation and then allowing them to search. It would be like if I called the police on a DV incident with my wife and the police came in, essentially we'd be saying, they can go ahead and start searching closed containers.
On a DV incident, you're not saying somebody hit my wife. She's over there. I don't know how they got in. Somebody hit it.
It's
a completely different situation. But this Mr. Phillips here said somebody broke in. Somebody did something to my house. That don't you think that imparts to the police that he's not the suspect, right?
I'm
saying somebody else did it.
I'm not saying that they didn't necessarily have that reasonable belief. But what we're talking about is, does he have no expectation of privacy any longer in his home because he calls 911 and he wants care for his wife? And I cannot agree with that.
What about Mr. Tsushima's? Sure, they can look at something, but they can't go into his computer. They can't go into a locked box.
Well, I guess what's unclear to me is what standard is he proposing to. I realize there are different standards. Federal case law has what's called an emergency doctrine, but even under that doctrine, it says that searches can't be related for, or they cannot be for the purpose of trying to find evidence related to the crime. If there's things that are discovered in attending to the emergency, then that's okay. But if there are, if it's purely motivated by obtaining and seizing evidence, then that's not okay.
But you're gonna, the test then is gonna turn on the motivation of police, but is that really the, is that an appropriate focus or a focus that can be easily or readily administered? Shouldn't the focus be on, was the officer in the location where he or she had a right to be, and then observed whatever he or she observed in plain view? And in this case, it would seem they had a right to be at least between the garage and the upstairs bedroom. They were invited directly into the garage, so they, the officer was in the very place where the officers had been invited to be. Why should the officer's motivation at that point matter? The fact that the subsequent officer was actually looking for something within the area where they had already clearly been invited to be?
Well, I think it matters only with respect to the plain view test. But the plain view test would only be applied, and I think was, I think rightfully it should be applied in this case to the situation. So I would agree the officer has a right to be where he is. But because there is an expectation of privacy by Mr. Phillips, even after inviting them into his home, then we should apply the plain view test. And under the plain view test, I realize that we can have a difference of opinion as to whether or not the discovery is inadvertent. But obviously my position would be that the discovery is not inadvertent.
Okay, but that's because the ICA gave a definition of inadvertent that's intentional, which is not consistent with the law at all. From Coolidge to Meyer to all these cases, what you look at is, does the person beforehand know the location of the evidence? If they don't know about its existence, how can it be, you know, then it's inadvertent if you don't know it's there. And plus, he could not have gotten a warrant for that hammer because he didn't know it existed. And that's what these cases say.
I understand that, Justice Pollack. The problem with that is that under that, if we're going to use that definition of that standard, then basically there would be no situation where there would be an inadvertent discovery. The discovery of the evidence would always be inadvertent if they didn't know, if all we're saying is, hey, they didn't know what they would find. But that's why I think that what Mr. Chief Justice was asking was, why is their motivation important? And it's important because Sergeant Kili'inui specifically ordered Officer Tokunaga to search for evidence of the crime. Now, if they were doing a sweep for suspects or other victims, that I can see would be different under an emergency doctrine type of exception, but not when they specifically said, hey, try and find evidence. They're specifically searching a constitutionally protected domain.
If we adopt your reasoning, won't we just be encouraging defendants to, just go ahead and call the police after, if they do commit a crime in their own home, and then argue that, then some, and say, you know, help me, somebody's attacked someone in my house, and then say, oh, you can't use that because you didn't have a warrant.
Justice McKenna, I think that there is a very simple solution to the problem that you're addressing, and that's, there is nothing wrong with the police obtaining express consent. We ask them to do it in Miranda. We place no burdens upon the defendant to say, hey, I don't want to. Arguably, person's not even informed. They don't even know that they have a right to not consent. And so what is wrong with, there's a perfectly valid, and federal case law talks about this as well.
So you're saying that the police should have said, can we search your house?
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong. There's a valid source of express consent, and the HPD should avail themselves of that source. So yes, I think that should be the message we send. It should not be, if we do the opposite and we say that it's on the defendants or it's on the homeowner to say, to revoke it or limit it or wait until he becomes a suspect, that's...
Should it be in writing? Because what if there's a dispute as to whether or not express consent was given?
I'm not necessarily advocating. I think obviously it would be better if it were in writing. That would leave no doubt that the defendant consented. And actually HPD does have a form to obtain written consent from homeowners for searching items or searching their home. But obviously that's not always possible. So
the How? So let's say that the police had said, can we search your house? And your client had said, no. Right?
Yep.
So then how do they can they just secure the house at that point?
Oh,
to make sure nothing's taken?
If they believe it's a crime scene and they believe that there's evidence that they want to search for, then yes, they should secure it and obtain a warrant if they feel there's probable cause to do that. And that's really the crux of this, is that there's nothing stopping them from doing that.
Probable cause to believe what?
To believe what?
To come onto a crime scene, what's their probable cause to believe? You're speculating that there's evidence of the crime.
Correct. Well, I'm not sure you're speculating. If after you've interviewed witnesses, you've interviewed the defendant, you feel that there is. Essentially, we cannot overcome his right to privacy in his home merely because
he called the police
to let them in.
An egregious crime had been committed.
That's correct.
He's invited into the police. He invites the police into the garage, and they see a hammer sitting on a box right in front of them.
That's correct.
And you're saying he has a reasonable expectation to the hammer.
I'm saying he has a reasonable expectation of privacy in that which is in his house. That does include the hammer, not because it's out in plain view and they couldn't have seen it. Like I said, if they went in and they said on the way into the house or while we were in the garage and they have permission to be there, we saw the hammer, that would be one thing. It is a completely different thing when they've said that they were specifically looking for evidence of the crime. That is not the same thing as saying it was just sitting out.
But they don't know that they're looking for a hammer until they go upstairs and see this person bludgeoned and blood splattered everywhere.
Correct.
So how would they know the relevance of a hammer until they go upstairs and they come back out again?
I'm not saying they would know, but the undisputed fact remains is that the sergeant ordered the officer to search for evidence. And if what we're saying is there's no probable cause to obtain a warrant, then there's no reason for them to be searching the house in the first place.
So if he had said, look around instead of look for evidence, it would have been okay in your view?
If he had said...
So his reasonable expectation of privacy depends on the officer's words?
No, that is not what I said. I'm saying that he always has a reasonable expectation of privacy. I'm saying there's a difference between letting them into your home to tend to an emergency and letting them into your home to search for evidence. There is a difference between those two. And I think that's why Justice Nakayama asked the question about why is it okay for the officers to go into a closed container? So where would we draw the line if we say, okay, they can come in and they're allowed to be there to tend to an emergency, they discovered the hammer and we're gonna call that plain view. That's one thing. But then where do we draw the line between, okay, why can they go into a rubbish can and discover more evidence?
Because that's not an area where pursuant to the plain, that's not an area where they had a right to be. In other words, they're there for a limited purpose, which is to, under your theory, which is to help respond to what happened to the defendant's wife. But they had a right to be anywhere between the garage and the bedroom, at least. And, you know, I guess it might be a more challenging case if perhaps it was in a different part of the house or somewhere other. But in this instance, it was right in the same area where they had the right to be. And you've said, had they seen it on the way in, it could have been recovered. So what is it in terms, from the point of view of the defendant's reasonable expectation of privacy, why should the officer's motivation in coming back to the very area where he had been invited to or the other officer had been invited to a few minutes before, why should that matter?
Right. I only bring that up in the context of our analysis under the plain view doctrine. So just so we're clear, I do think that because there is an expectation of privacy, we have to analyze both the hammer and the clothing under the appropriate doctrines. For the hammer, that's plain view. The only reason why I mention the officer's motivation is because I think that goes to the inadvertence requirement under the plain view doctrine. Now, if that fails because that hasn't been defined, or as Justice Pollack said, it's still inadvertent, that is one thing. But what I'm making clear is that we should not be creating a brand new exception under implied consent. There is an expectation of privacy that is and that remains our position. So
you're saying there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in that garage?
Absolutely. absolutely. And that's why I think we are properly analyzing these two pieces of evidence under for the hammer of the plain view doctrine. That's the only reason why I bring up officer's motivation.
Even assuming you could make an argument, which I have a difficulty obviously with, that he exhibited an expectation of privacy when he invited them into the garage and moving them in. But is society going to call that reasonable when there's this egregious crime committed and you invite people in? We're supposed to call it a reasonable expectation of privacy in a garage after?
You know, I'm not going to pretend to know how society as a whole would feel about this. I think what we can do is look legally at what Hawaii case law has talked about. I think we can look at the fact that the Hawaii Constitution has an additional Article 1, Section 6 provides basically even more privacy protections for its citizens than the Fourth Amendment or the Constitution does. And I would say yes, in Hawaii, at any rate, there is basically a heightened and additional expectation of privacy. So I cannot stand here and say that if you call 911, you invite police into your home, that basically you're saying I no longer have any expectation of privacy.
What if the wife had been in the garage? What if it wasn't a hammer but a gun? Mm-hmm. And you know your client, you know, a defendant calls and says, "My wife has been shot mm-hmm. in the garage. Come police, come ambulance, help, help." And then he invites the police into the garage, mm-hmm. and the gun is there. Right?
Correct.
There's a reasonable expectation of privacy?
There is a reasonable expectation of privacy. The question would then turn on, well, I guess it depends. I would need more facts to, I guess, properly answer your question. If you're saying that the gun was
lying on a cooler,
mm-hmm. if the police had said that in going into the garage to tend to the wife, we noticed the gun, then that would be a plain view observation.
What if the gun was on a cooler, but the cooler was partially hidden by a box or something?
Well, then it would depend on the motivation, as Mr. Chief Justice says.
So at that point, there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, and a warrant would have been required, even as the police officers were walking around, happened to see the gun.
Well, I'm going to say yes. You still have, because it's your dwelling, you still have a reasonable expectation of privacy. It's a very fine line. I understand. I'm not trying to split hairs between inviting police into your home, but there is a difference between allowing them into your home for emergency purposes and allowing them into your home to search for evidence, to search through whether the containers are closed or not. There is a difference.
Well, what was the emergency then?
The emergency in this situation was that his wife had been attacked.
Well, why do you need the police for that?
Because his belief at the time, or the inference anyway, is that somebody had entered his home and attacked his wife.
So then what's the emergency? That the evidence might disappear? I mean, what's the emergency? I don't understand the emergency.
The emergency is that his wife was attacked. So he needs the police, he needs ambulance in his home to tend to his wife. But
he doesn't need the police to tend to his wife, right?
Well, he needs the police if he believes that somebody else had entered his home and he doesn't know who that was.
In order to investigate. Why, following up Justice McKenna, why do you need the police unless it's to investigate a crime that has occurred?
The difference is that if this same incident occurs out on the street, then there is no question that the police can investigate crimes. They can do what they need to do to investigate something that happens on the street. But we're talking about a dwelling where it is uncontroverted that citizens have a right to privacy. And so I'm not saying that.
Is it at all by him invoking the powers of the police to come to his house? That doesn't diminish his right to privacy at all?
To the extent that they're allowed into his home, yes. To the extent that they can start searching for evidence, no. There is a difference. So once she's removed from the home, then basically his expectation of privacy should be fully restored. But But I don't think that we should necessarily split hairs and say that he has no expectation of privacy just because he invites them into his home. The other thing I did want to bring up that Justin McKenna sort of collaterally touched on is there is a difference also between search and seizure. And in my briefing I've alluded to the idea that the search is, while a search might be constitutional, a seizure of that same evidence can be unconstitutional. Now, 9 times out of 10, we talk about search and seizure as if they're the same thing, because 9 times out of 10, we know what it is. If it's a gun, then it's obvious that that's contraband. If it's drugs, it's obvious that it's contraband. So the mere discovery of it is also the seizure. In this instance, and in 1 out of 10 cases, there is a difference. There, Meyer talks about, and I know that's an open view case, but Meyer talks about that even if a search is constitutional, an item can still be in a constitutionally protected place, and therefore the seizure might not be.
What time did the questioning of the defendant begin at the police station?
The questioning of the defendant, well, no, arguably it began before that. That's why Judge Ott suppressed statements even prior to him.
All those statements about the fugitive were before, correct. And this hammer was actually seized at 9:35 a.m., correct?
Was I would say that's when it was seized, correct.
Well, wait a minute. I'm not so sure that's when it was
when
seized.
When was it seized?
It was recovered at 9:30.
Correct.
You just talked about what a seizure is.
Right.
A seizure doesn't mean necessarily removal.
Correct.
Seizure can be, and the way it's defined often, is when it's an interference with a person's possessory rights. As soon as that object was observed, there was no way the police were going to allow anybody to touch it, so probably the seizure occurs as soon as he tells the police officer. And secondly, to require a seizure the moment it's seen would have compromised the evidence. They had to wait for the evidence tech people to arrive,
right.
And proof of it is they found DNA later.
Right. The problem I have with that, Justice Pollack, is that is a looking back position. At the point that they noticed the hammer, they don't know anything other than that it's wet. They did notice what they appear to be a spot of blood on it, but they're not. It's not the same as a gun or drugs, where it's very obvious that what you're looking at is contraband, just like the clothes inside the rubbish container. It's not obvious what it is. So
your argument is that they should have just picked it up right then?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there needs to be exigency before they seize it. And so what I'm saying is the seizure is when they recover it, is when...
That's not what the plain view doctrine says.
I'm not speaking to the plain view doctrine. I'm speaking to that there being a difference between an unconstitutional search. So even if we justify the discovery of it under the plain view doctrine, there's still a problem with why can't they just secure the home and then basically seize it pursuant to a warrant. But they still made a warrant, a seizure of that evidence 5 hours later.
No, they had a right. Under the plain view doctrine, they have a right to seize it immediately. And if they want to, under the circumstances, as long as they don't make the wait too long, they can wait and bring in their evidence tech and pick it up that way.
I believe the plain view doctrine could, I'm not conceding this, but could justify the search and the discovery of the hammer. It does not in any way justify the seizure. I disagree that the discovery of it is the seizure. The Fourth Amendment...
Under the plain view doctrine, if a police see something in plain view, they actually have to go get a warrant before they can recover it?
I'm saying that in this situation where they're in a situation where they can secure an item, they can secure its location, then yes, the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 7 demand that a warrant be obtained before they can seize an item. The search and the discovery of it are separate from its seizure.
There's no case that says that. That's a new plain view. That's our second corollary on the plain view.
There's no plain view case that talks about that, but as I said, Meyer talks about a search being constitutional but a seizure being unconstitutional. Rodriguez, which is the case about the gentleman with the drugs in his pocket, specifically said that the officer was entitled to a pat-down search. He was not authorized to seize that evidence. So when he turned his pockets inside out and the drugs came out, that was an unconstitutional seizure. But it specifically said that the search is okay. The search is constitutional because it's pursuant to a lawful arrest. So even though it hasn't been discussed in a plain view context, there is a difference between search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 7. And in this instance, there is absolutely no exigency that exists that would entitle the police to seize this evidence before a warrant is obtained.
So your argument is the plain view doctrine requires an exigency to seize evidence that has been rightfully observed.
I'm saying in this situation where it is not clear that the item you're dealing with is contraband. If the item you're dealing with is clearly contraband and is related to the crime at hand, then that could potentially justify the seizure. But in this instance, we're talking about a hammer, and there's no reason why they can't secure the residence. There's no reason for them to make a warrantless seizure of it.
And you say didn't the officer say that he saw like a drop of something that appeared to be, okay, here's his testimony. When you located the hammer, what indication did you have that it was a possible weapon? Answer, I believe there was a spot of blood on top of the hammer.
That's his observation, correct.
I understand. And that isn't enough?
Just a follow-up. Hammers aren't like, they're not necessarily like pieces of paper people use hammers when they work on their home. It could have been paint, it could have been anything. My point is simply that if...
Next question. So there was at least one stain that resembled blood, yes.
That is the officer's observation, correct. But there's nothing that justifies seizing that hammer without a warrant. That is merely my point. I am running out of time. With respect to the clothing, because we haven't focused too much on it, but it is obviously of equal importance to this case, if I understand correctly, we are still analyzing this under the doctrine of inevitable discovery. And recent case law, specifically Rodriguez, again, this test fails. The circuit court's order simply says the clothing would inevitably have been discovered on the strength of the search warrant. She offers no facts as support for that conclusion, whereas Rodriguez specifically requires a clear and convincing showing by the government that the defendant is incapable of retrieving and discarding the contraband, the defendant was restrained in such a way as to make it incapable of discarding it. There was no evidence in this case of continuous observation of Mr. Phillips. There's no testimony as to what would have happened if he returned home and he wanted to enter his home. The state talks about in its briefing that...
Why wasn't the clothing claim you? Under your definition, you said as long as you're not ordered to search, that officer wasn't ordered to search, he was throwing out a Kleenex. Observes it.
Why is it not subject to the plain view?
Yeah.
It fails the first prong of the plain view doctrine that the intrusion was lawful. There is no way we can...
The officer's in the place where he has a right to be.
He's in a place where he has a right to be. He has absolutely no right to open that garbage can, even to throw away rubbish. He has no right. He's at a home. These guys are taught better than that.
What if he had to go to the bathroom?
What if he had to go to the bathroom?
Okay, so he would have to ask, can I use your restroom?
I would say yes. This is not like...
And what if something was in the restroom there?
If he had gotten consent and he discovered something, then we'd be talking about something different. We'd be talking about potentially...
So if police are invited into someone's home for a search because of a crime, they can't go to the bathroom then, right? They can't use the restroom in the house. They have to drive away and go.
Correct. And he certainly was not in any way entitled to open that. So it would not apply under the plain view. Now, how the circuit court analyzed it was under the doctrine of inevitable discovery, but again, there just wasn't clear and convincing evidence that evidence would have still been there when they executed the warrant. And the warrant, again, was executed 15 to 16 hours after the discovery of the clothing. Where was the defendant?
Yeah,
the defendant was at HPD from maybe... He interviewed with the detectives from, I can't remember, for a couple hours, from maybe 8 to 10 or 8 to 11, and then he was released.
And was the scene secure?
The stipulation was that the scene was secure. Now, it's unclear how long it was secure for. So when detectives Nakamura and Sunia returned with their warrant, there is no evidence, no testimony, no indication of whether or not HPD had still... had that scene secured or whether or not they vacated the premises.
But the clothes were still in the trash can.
The clothes were not. The clothes were taken away at 9:35 a.m.
I see.
By Officer Eliza.
I see.
Again, without a warrant.
I see.
So you don't think that if they hadn't taken the hammer and the clothes away, they would have secured the house until the warrant could be served?
I'm not, I don't think I'm, I should speculate as to what they would or wouldn't have done. I think that the standard is that the government showed by clear and convincing evidence that that would have been, or that that was the situation, and they failed to do that. That just wasn't done in this case, and too much time has gone by with respect to when that warrant was obtained and executed.
Anything else at this time, Mr. Hiranaka?
I guess just to wrap up, since I'm out of time, that this case does involve well-established principles of law, plain view doctrine, inevitable discovery doctrine. I do not think we should be...
What about exigent circumstances? What is the rule on that again?
I think... My opinion, and I realize there may be disagreement on this, is that that only applies with respect to whether or not you believe there's a difference between the unconstitutional search and an unconstitutional seizure. So if we believe that the search or discovery of, say, the hammer was constitutional, the exigency would only play a role if you believe that the police needed to seize the hammer immediately under exigent circumstances.
And why not? Why wouldn't that apply in this situation?
There's no exigency. The Lincoln Head was down at the police station at 9:35 a.m. when they took control of the hammer, and there was no reason for them to not be able to.
But he returned at noon.
I don't know what time he returned. There was no evidence of that in the record. But the point is that because the HPD were the only people on scene, they could have secured and obtained the warrant. There was nothing stopping them from doing that. Exigency would only apply if there was a reason for them to seize it right away.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Tsushima, your rebuttal.
The first thing I wanted to point out was the thing that Justice McKenna brought up.
Well, the light is still on. I'm sorry.
With regard to the fugitive and when that was brought up, when it was first brought up was in the June 22nd, 09 transcript, page 55. Also untestified, it was when they're sitting in the dining room. So that was after he had moved defendant from the position sitting in the car in the garage into the dining room. So it was before he was taken down to the police station for interview. I apologize for not knowing that earlier. The second point I wanted to address was with regard to the scope of the search, counsel had asked what standard is the state proposing that should be applied, and it was the standard that the state had already mentioned under State v. Nakamoto. And that's the scope of the search must be reasonably related to its purpose. So we're not proposing that a bright line standard be met, but that this court look at whether the scope of the search was reasonably related to its purpose. The third thing I wanted to address was counsel's proposal that express consent should be applied, and that there should be an express consent given, and that implied consent is not enough. But what this court looks at are the individual's words, gestures, or conduct. Would it be easier for us had express consent been given, or when it's given? Of course, it would be much easier. But what this court looks at.
What if the police had asked, "Can we search your house?" And he had said no. What would the police's options be at that point?
I believe then exigency might apply, because at that point they would have a reason to believe that there's possible evidence that might be destroyed. So at that point, I think that exception would have applied.
Based on its negative response?
Based on the information that they knew that of the surrounding circumstances of his wife having been bludgeoned in her bedroom and coming upon him at the garage, and for him to say, no, I don't want you to come in. Yes, I would think as society that we would expect the officers to want to investigate the circumstances.
Could they secure the house at that point, keep him out, and go get a warrant at that point?
I believe that's a more difficult question. I think what we will, as a society, want the police officers to do is just investigate initially what the surrounding circumstances are. So I don't know that I could say that they necessarily could.
See, I'm not that familiar with police procedure. So is that something they could have done? Could they have said, could they have asked, can we search your house? He says no. And then can they say, okay, then we're going to secure the house. You have to leave. We're going to go get a warrant.
I believe exigency may apply in that situation, that exception may apply, because the police
I'm just, I'm not asking about the exigency. I'm just saying, can they, could they have done that? Could they have secured the house and gotten a warrant at that point?
Yes.
Well, the implied consent, aside from all the problems that the implied consent allowing a suspect to be able to revoke, giving that sort of power, you know, the United States Supreme Court specifically reserved ruling. They haven't even actually ruled that it's legal. I'm sure you're aware. So that's, you're asking us to adopt a doctrine that, that perhaps could be subsequently invalidated and has concerns that it would allow someone, a suspect, as soon as he becomes a suspect, to revoke it.
And I'm not asking this court to adopt it. It's a doctrine which this court has adopted.
Well, the alternative is a diminished expectation of privacy, which this court has applied before.
Correct. Yes. And what this court would look at under the implied consent is words, gestures, or conduct. If the evidence and the facts do not meet the court's satisfaction, then the evidence is suppressed. So that's why the implied consent doctrine is not problematic for this court to rule on the issues. What counsel has not disputed are any of the facts in this case as presented to this court this morning, and which this court will be examining de novo review of the constitutional question before it. In this case, the police did exactly what one of their jobs is, and that's to investigate when called upon. With regard to the police discovery of the hammer and the bloody clothing, the police committed no misconduct, but rather did what society would expect of them. It's for these reasons that we ask this court to vacate the decision of the ICA and affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you very much. If there are no further questions, the court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you to both of our attorneys today. The court will stand in recess. Thank you.